Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Yesterday, the University of Southern California made it official. Reggie Bush did, in fact, go to USC. That really happened. Okay, well, maybe it wasn't exactly like that, but it was pretty much like that. Because yesterday, the school announced that Bush's 10-year NCAA-mandated disassociation was finally over. School president Carol Folt wrote a letter to Bush, which included the following, and I quote, "I am pleased to inform you that all restrictions and prohibitions on your involvement in our athletics program are officially removed, and you will be afforded the privileges and courtesies extended to Trojan football alumni," end quote. Great. Awesome. So apparently now it is okay to admit that this really did happen.
Trying to take the lead here. Reggie Bush, left side, look out. 30, 20, 10, forget it. Reggie Bush, touchdown. Reggie Bush tonight, 12 carries, 198 yards, and a touch.
Not everybody can do that. I mean, there's about two or three people in the history of football that can make that move.
Right. Not everybody can do that. So now apparently, since the punishment is over, we don't have to act like that never happened. We don't have to act like he never attended that school. We don't have to act like he never toted the rock for USC. The football program's official Twitter account posted a highlight reel with the caption, "Welcome home, Reggie Bush." Then Bush, in a statement, said, quote, "I've dreamed of this day for 10 plus years, and I'm excited to come home," end of quote. I'm hyped too, Reg. I'm hyped that this whack punishment is finally over. Like, the NCAA has done some pretty jacked up things in its time, but the disassociation punishment for Reggie Bush is right near the top of that list. Vacated wins and show cause penalties think that disassociation was weird as hell. I mean, you will recall the conscious uncoupling. It came after the NCAA investigation that concluded that Bush and family members had received extra benefits at USC. So the school received a 2-year bowl ban, a reduction in scholarships. Bush had to return his Heisman Trophy, and USC had to then pretend that Reggie Bush never even existed. And this went on for a decade. And what that meant was he was not welcome on campus. He was not involved with the program in any capacity until that was finally relaxed a little bit last fall when he returned to the Coliseum as a broadcaster. But his name and his stats, well, they appeared in USC's most recent media guide, but they still had notes that pointed out that some of his accomplishments were impacted by an NCAA penalty. So what I'm saying is this. For 10 years, the school pretty much had to ignore Reggie Bush. They had to ignore their most iconic and impactful player of this century. It's just weird. Really weird. Like, they just erased this dude completely. Hell, O.J. Simpson was afforded more respect from USC over the past decade than Reggie Bush was. And this disassociation, exactly who did that serve? Did the NCAA think that everybody would just forget that he went to USC? That everyone was just going to erase those games from their heads and that we wouldn't talk about that? How exactly was that supposed to work? Like, if two people were in a bar and they got into a bargument talking about the greatest running backs of all time, was some NCAA narc or even narc bra himself, Silk, was either narc bra or an NCAA narc going to just kind of roll up on that conversation, interrupt them and say, excuse me, sir, I'm going to have to report you to authorities because you're talking about Reggie Bush. He can't be on your list because he didn't go to USC. He's dead to us. So keep his name out your mouth because none of that stuff you're talking about ever happened. Is that how that was supposed to go? And yes, I know there was an NCAA investigation. I know it found that Bush and his family received benefits. And as any USC honk would tell you, those benefits did not come as part of the recruiting process. Those benefits were there to convince him to leave. They weren't even there to convince him to stay. They were there to convince him to leave. But honestly, at this point, I'm not really sure how that much or how that matters at all. Because the more time has passed, the less important those violations feel. Nobody is sweating the sanctity and purity of amateur athletics anymore. That conversation has shifted so much. We're now talking about college athletes being compensated for their name, their image, and their likeness. But that doesn't change the fact that that was a really, really weird punishment. Like, we all had to act like he didn't go to USC. We all had to act like he didn't wear number 5. We all had to act like he was not the most electric player any of us had seen in our lifetimes. Man, it's so weird that he did, in fact, have to return his Heisman. But USC still displays O.J. Simpson's Heisman. That's like the weirdest part of all. They kept O.J.'s Heisman, but not Reggie Bush's. They associated more with a killer than they did a guy who received some impermissible benefits. Yeah, pretty hard to forget Reggie Bush. Pretty hard to forget Reggie Bush at USC. When I think pound for pound, he was probably the most electric running back I've ever seen in college. A home run threat every time he touched the ball. An icon to the young ballers who came after him. We were supposed to just forget that. Yeah, nice try. Because you know what? That never happened. No one actually ever did that. USC may have disassociated itself from Reggie, but nobody else did. I know I didn't. I can't tell you how many hours of my life I lost going down the YouTube rabbit holes for his highlights. Over the past 10 years, this clip was always there when I went to look for it. Apparently, USC couldn't scrub the internet because when I went looking for this clip, it was always there, and I need it one more time.
Reggie Bush right up the middle, hits the outside. He's at the 30. It's another foot race. Cuts it back to the 20, comes back to the near side of the field. He is going to go. It's going to be another USC touchdown and another thing of beauty from one of the best running backs you've ever seen.
How many words are there to describe this run? Look at this. It's a zone play. He gets up, coming up the sideline untouched. I don't think he was ever touched. Then he stops, puts his chest out, comes back around the field. That's a guy not only with great ability.
So that ridiculous play really did happen, whether he was allowed back on campus or not. In that ridiculous game where he had 513 total yards, that really happened, whether or not the school has his jersey or not. And then finally, you know who really did not disassociate Reggie Bush from USC? Everybody who plays the game. He is still an absolute legend to high school players today. They know who he is, they know where he went to school, and they know what he accomplished, because those clips are electric. And as dumb as it was for the school, as Bush told Bruce Feldman last month, it was a burden that he carried on a very deep level. He said, quote, "It was a horrible feeling, one of the worst feelings in the world. I felt like I died when I had to hear that there weren't going to be scholarships for kids because of me or because of something connected to me. I'm still not over that. It's just something you learn to live with," end quote. Well, maybe now, finally, we can start to get over it because that dopey discipline is finally over. Reg, welcome home. Welcome home, Reg. It's like you never even left, even if they did hold a memorial and bury you alive. He is Will Brinson. What's going on, Will? How are you?
Jim, what's going on, man? Hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. How about you? What's up?
Not much. Just trying to make it through the rest of the week. Got a little, spend a week with the in-laws, which will involve, at the beach, which will involve not much work, a substantial amount of beer, and probably getting yelled at for playing too much golf.
There you go, man. Numb up. All right, so what's your sense, Will, about the rest of the NFL offseason? How is it going to play out in your mind in terms of training camps and exhibition games? What does that look like?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're looking at, Jim, is probably, you know, people are wondering, will there be a surge of a wave of free agency now that things are sort of opening back up? I would say no. This is, you know, these NFL types and people around the league are very, they have a body calendar, a body clock, right? And this is the time of year when, you know, you get that 1 month where you can sort of step away. And I know everybody's sort of been with their families a lot, but I would anticipate sort of the NFL, you know, taking a breath, spending the next 30 days or so trying to figure out if a vacation can happen or, you know, taking a vacation near their homes, getting some additional family time, and then report back for training camp as normal. It could start a couple of days earlier. I know Pete Briscoe was chatting about that with us recently. You know, there's talk that maybe they come back for camps a little bit earlier to try and make up some of the ground they lost. You got to work out with the NFLPA if that can actually happen. But then I think they'll do training camp as normal, maybe socially distance a bit, and then you probably end up in a situation where we get a normal preseason, albeit with less games. I would anticipate that this is sort of, you know, they'll be going to three anyway next year if they expand the season to 17 games. So what you do is you give teams a longer training camp. You can sort of ease them in a little bit more, and you cut it down to two preseason games. That costs the owners a bunch of money, but, you know, spoiler, these guys are billionaires and would rather have a good product on the field, I think, than those extra two preseason games. And plus, when you talk about preseason games, yeah, you're losing money from sponsorships and TV broadcast rights and all that, but, you know, primarily you're talking about ticket sales, and we don't know what the setup's going to be for those sales right now. We anticipate it's not going to be a full stadium worth of fans, so it makes sense to hack that thing in half and to make it easier on the financial burden of your PSL owners, your fans, et cetera. So I think that's the plan. Now, having said all that, you know, you look around at some of these states, you know, North Carolina included, Arizona, Texas, Florida, where there wasn't a real big bad outbreak of corona in the early going. And, I mean, frankly, like some of the numbers coming out in the last 24 to 48 hours aren't great. Like North Carolina updated their dashboard a few minutes ago, and it's, you know, it's like you don't want to see 5.6% positive tests jump up to 6.8% positive. That's not a good number in the middle of June. So I think everything's still up in the air, but that's kind of the tentative plan they've got right now.
Hey, listen, whether you're working from home or working on your fitness, you want to make sure that what you're listening to is what you're listening to, not what your roommates or neighbors or significant others are listening to. Everybody needs a great pair of wireless earbuds, but before you go dropping hundreds of bucks on a pair, you need to check out the wireless earbuds from Raycon. Now, you already know Raycon earbuds start at about half the price of any other premium wireless earbuds on the market, and they sound just as amazing as the other top audio brands that you know. Now, check this. Their newest model, the Everyday E25 earbuds, are the best ones to date. 6 hours of playtime, seamless Bluetooth pairing, more bass, and a more compact design that gives you a nice noise-isolating fit. You've heard me talk about how the company was co-founded by Ray J and celebrities like Snoop Dogg, Cardi B, J.R. Smith. They're all obsessed with Raycons. Pick up a pair and see what all the hype is all about. Now it's time to get the latest and greatest from Raycon. Get 15% off your order at buyraycon.com/Rome. These earbuds are amazing. Find out for yourself. Go to buyraycon.com/Rome and get 15% off. Buyraycon.com/Rome. We are talking to Will Brinson. All right, Will, this is one of my least favorite topics, but Dak Prescott, his contract. From your understanding, where do things stand with a new deal for Dak Prescott?
Yeah, and I'm with you. It's sort of like talking about Jadeveon, like where will Jadeveon Clowney sign? Like how many days in a row can we do this, right? I mean, I think the Cowboys are in a position where they want to get Dak locked in for something in the range of, you know, $33 to $35 million over 5+ years. But the problem for them is that, you know, even though Dak understands what it means to have the star on your helmet and all the benefits that come with it, you know, they let it get to a point where, I mean, he's 2 years away, Jim, from it. Doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter what Patrick Mahomes, you know, like whether he's better or not. He's 2 years away from being a completely unrestricted free agent and hitting the market at his age, with his pedigree, potentially improving his stats in Mike McCarthy's system and all the weapons around them and a questionable defense. I mean, he's a viable MVP candidate this year, and I think he's probably willing to see what the franchise tag can give him. And the further you get down that road, we saw it with Cousins and the Redskins, and there was more animosity there. But the further you get down that road, the more dangerous it becomes for Dallas, because every new deal, suddenly there's a new benchmark for Dak. Once you play out one franchise tag, you know, you lose more and more leverage. So I think Dak probably wants something closer, you know, something closer to $40 million a year, which sounds crazy. But, you know, I mean, it's just the market. It's not about whether Dak is a better quarterback than Russell Wilson. That has nothing to do with it. It has everything to do with where does Dak stand in relation to the market? Where does he stand in relation to his contract being up and the franchise tag being up? And he has all the leverage right now because the Cowboys botched it by signing Ezekiel Elliott before they signed Dak.
Exactly. I say this all the time, Will. It's not even about is he the better quarterback? Does he have the better numbers? It's about timing, and it's about the market. And it's always about who's up next, whose turn is next, and Dak is up next. It's about the timing. Now, in terms of quarterbacks, Will Brinson, my guest, you mentioned Pete Prisco. Prisco is an enormous Josh Allen fan. Through the first two seasons in Buffalo, what does he look like to you as a quarterback?
You know, it's nuts. So we're doing this all 32 podcast thing where we cover it. We get a writer from or somebody who knows the team intimately, and we bring them on. We're doing it for the Pick Six podcast, and check it out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, etc. But we had Matthew Fairburn from The Athletic on for the Bills, and I mean, I guess I knew this, but he said it, and I still didn't believe it. Josh Allen doesn't have a 300-yard passing game in his career. That's crazy. I mean, the dude's been in the NFL for 2 years, and I think that sort of speaks to it. It's like there remains this tantalizing upside to Josh Allen where if he puts it all together, he can have an MVP season this year. And the Bills have done their due diligence in providing him an average to better than average offensive line, sort of building it out in a blue-collar way. And now I've gotten him Stephon Diggs, a true number one, who pairs really nicely with Cole Beasley and John Brown. Dawson Knox, an underrated tight end, coming into his second year. So the weapons are there. The offensive line is there. And he's regarded in the locker room as a leader. The question is, can he take a leap in terms of his production in the passing game? And I think ultimately, you know, we sort of sound cliche, I guess, but I mean, the Bills have a very high floor. Their roster is really good. I think they're the floor of an 8-9 win team. I mean, that's just, you know, Sean McDermott and Brandon Bean have done a good job turning them around. They have the ceiling, if Josh Allen makes a leap in his third year, of being a Super Bowl team, which is crazy to think. So it really all comes down to, can Josh Allen improve as a passer? Can he improve his touch on deep balls? Can he improve his accuracy on shorter passes? I mean, can he just be a better passer from the pocket and maybe rely a little bit less on his legs, or at least just become more accurate as a thrower? And if he can do that, then the Bills have a huge ceiling, and he's going to make a ton of money. You know, if he takes a step back at all, or he sort of stagnates, then things could get a little weird in Buffalo as it relates to their win total and his contract.
We're talking to Will Brinson. All right, Will, one more thought before you go. Time moves in a really strange way right about now. It's hard to believe, for instance, that it's only been 1 week since Drew Brees made his comments about Colin Kaepernick and peaceful protests. In the hours and days after that, it seemed like the Saints might be on the verge of ripping apart. What's your sense as to where that team is right now?
Yeah, I mean, look, I can't speak to another man's intentions, Jim, but I think that what Drew Brees did in terms of his apologies and then his tweets in direct response to President Donald Trump tweeting about Drew Brees apologizing, I think that what he did covered the necessary ground and covered the necessary bases. And not only did he did those things publicly, he also spoke at length with his teammates. And you saw it in actions from guys who came out and talked about it. DeMario Davis, Michael Thomas tweeted about, that's my QB. It was like, he covered all his bases, whether he did it as a public relations thing or whether he did it actually learning and educating himself and becoming, a better person. I think it worked. And I think the Saints are in a very good spot right now. Now, what will happen when training camp opens is there's going to be a flurry of media, and it'll probably be what I like to call like a CNN, CNN situation where like the national media descends on it because they want to get Drew Brees' comments because they're going to run some sort of thing. CBS News will be there, et cetera. But I think that Brees has bridged the gap back to his teammates after his comments enough that it won't be a big deal barring something else surfacing or some other comments being made. And you would think at this point that he understands where everything sort of shakes out. So in my opinion, a pretty impressive job by Drew Brees sort of reversing where the tide was going in a pretty quick fashion.
I've got one bonus topic for you before you go, Will. There's been some noise about Matt Patricia and how he runs things in Detroit. Remember, Jim Caldwell was 36-28 in 4 seasons with the Lions. Patricia was hired to get them over the hump. Instead, he's gone 9-22-1. How badly does he need to win this season?
Oh, real bad. I mean, it's just one of those things where the impression, and we did a Lions podcast too, the impression of ownership. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, Jim, Martha Firestone Ford, the wealthy billionaire Lions owner, an octogenarian, nicknamed in college, Stoney, which makes sense because she's Firestone. But, you know, if you're nicknamed Stoney in college in 2020, it's probably for a different reason. I was floored when I found that on Wikipedia. But yeah, I mean, like, she was under the impression Matt Patricia comes in and you go from 9-7 2 years in a row with Jim Caldwell to 10-6, 11-5, 12-4, and you become a Super Bowl caliber team. And that hadn't happened. One thing that I think is very notable when you look at this Lions roster, they did, and this happens a lot with, you know, seeing in Tennessee and Houston, other places where former Belichick disciples go. But the Lions imported a ton of New England guys or ex-New England guys this particular offseason. And, you know, they ship out an unhappy Darius Slay. I think they really wanted to focus on, especially in this offseason with the way things were operating, knowing that they have a locker room that can be a little bit more cohesive and they have some leaders who will have Matt Patricia's back. And so I think, if Matthew Stafford stays healthy – and DeAndre Swift and Kerryon Johnson can provide a legitimate top tier running attack, this team can actually sneak out that division. I know that sounds crazy, but you can kind of see it if you squint. So I could be in on the Lions this year. I'm sure I'll regret it by week three.
Hey, listen, hopefully you're right, because if I know Stoney the way I think I know Stoney, Stoney ain't having it. Stoney ain't having
Stoney
that.
Stoney don't play, man.
Not at all. He is a CBS Sports senior writer. He is the owner of Tea Time at the Masters, the cookbook, good friend of the program, and the host of the Pick 6 podcast. He is Will Brinson. Will, great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Always fun, Jim. Take it easy, man.
All right, so Sunday, NASCAR driver Bubba Wallace wore a shirt which read, "I can't breathe, Black Lives Matter," before the race in Atlanta. Monday night, NASCAR driver Bubba Wallace talked about the change that he wanted to see in the sport.
We were trying to figure out next steps, and my next step would be to get rid of all Confederate flags. There should be no individual that is uncomfortable showing up to our events to have a good time with their family that feels some type of way about something they have seen, an object they have seen flying. No one should feel uncomfortable when they come to a NASCAR race. So it starts with Confederate flags. Get them out of here. They have no place for them.
That is strong. That's strong. That's powerful. And that is absolutely correct. And he knew that that might not be a popular stance with some people. Quote, "There's going to be a lot of angry people that carry those flags proudly, but it's time for change. We have to change that. And I encourage NASCAR, we will have those conversations to remove those flags." End quote. NASCAR then made its statement yesterday. Quote, "The presence of the Confederate flag at NASCAR events runs contrary to our commitment to providing a welcoming and inclusive environment for all fans, our competitors, and our industry. Bringing people together around a love for racing and the community that it creates is what makes our fans and sports special. The display of the Confederate flag will be prohibited from all NASCAR events and properties." End of quote. Just like that, Bubba did it. That's outstanding. It really is. That's really good news. NASCAR attempted to disallow it at races 5 years ago after white supremacist Dylan Roof murdered 9 black men and women in a church. Wallace, wearing an American flag on his face mask and a "I can't breathe" shirt, was pumped before the race.
Bravo. Props to NASCAR and everybody involved. I'm excited about tonight, man. There's a lot of emotions on the racetrack and off the racetrack that are riding with us, but tonight is something special. Today's been special. Again, hats off to NASCAR. Phelps and I have been in contact a lot, just trying to figure out what steps are next, and that was a huge pivotal moment for the sport.
That was a huge pivotal moment for that sport. But not everybody was happy. Ray Cicerelli, a part-time competitor in the NASCAR Gander RV, an outdoors truck series, posted the following on Facebook. Quote, "Well, it's been a fun ride and a dream come true, but if this is the direction NASCAR is headed, we will not participate after 2020 is over. I don't believe in kneeling during the anthem, nor taking people's right to fly whatever flag they love. I could care less about the Confederate flag, but there are people that do, and it doesn't make them a racist. All you are doing is bleeping one group to cater to another, and I ain't spend the money we are to participate in any political BS. So everything is for sale, end quote. Thanks for your thoughts on that, Raymond. But I'm going to go ahead and say that zero wins, zero polls, and just one top 10 finish in the last 3 years means I'm not sure anybody's even going to notice that you're gone or that you were even there in the first place. And as for this notion that flying the Confederate flag does not make you a racist, I hate to break it to you, it pretty much does. It was a flag flown by traitors, people who were fighting against America for the right to own slaves. I mean, it really is that simple. But don't take it from me. Take it from Ryan McGee, who wrote an incredible piece for ESPN. You really should read it. Here's part. Quote, "I am a direct descendant of slave owners. My family still owns the home where my forefathers lived while the human beings they owned worked all around them." He continues, quote, "My great-great-great-grandfather and uncle were taken prisoner after fighting under that flag and was shipped off to a prison camp in Elmira, New York, a.k.a. Helmyra. And when the Civil War ended, they walked home 600 miles to Rockingham, North Carolina." And there's still more. He goes on, quote, "So yeah, spare me the arguments about what the flag really means. I know exactly what it means. It means pain. It means anguish. It means embarrassment. It means the most shameful blight on the pages of the history of the United States, and that's no small achievement." He continues, and I quote, "Even if there had ever been a stitch of honor left in that flag after the Civil War was over, that was wrung out when hate groups chose the stars and bars as their go-to banner, under which they set fire to crosses, lynched black Americans, and held aloft as they stood at the doors of desegregated schools and screamed at innocent children, school books in hand, who did nothing more than be born." End quote. You see, that's what that flag represents. And that's what you're siding with when you fly it. Honestly, McGee's piece is so good. I mean, I actually thought about reading the entire column on the air. It's that good. Bubba Wallace also was not alone. Ryan Blaney, who finished second last night, also supports him.
"I'm really proud of what he's doing, the effort he's putting in and wanting to, you know, kind of lead the charge, you know, and I stand behind him. A lot of guys stand behind him, not only the drivers, but a lot of teams as well, crew members. The car he ran tonight was great. I love that they were able to do that and they came up with that idea."
Also, let's not forget, Dale Earnhardt was opposed to the Confederate flag. Junior has spoken out against it for years. In his autobiography, he wrote that it, quote, "represents closed-minded, racist views that have no place in today's society," end quote. Dale Earnhardt Jr. has been saying this for years. That was right out of his book. And now NASCAR has banned it from their tracks. It is a strong step in the right direction, and it's absolutely the right call. And before you come in here and tell me I don't know what that flag represents, don't, because I do. That's the right move. Absolutely, that's the right move. Obviously. Of course, I'm speaking of Mac Brown. Mac, it is so good to have you on. Before we get into all of this, Mac, how are you, Sally, and everybody around you right now?
Tim, we're all doing really well. We've talked about these crazy times, and, you know, you and I went through 9/11. I've been through the racial uprisings in the 60s with President Johnson, and I remember Mr. Meredith having to have escorts going to college at Ole Miss, and I remember Selma, and I remember Dr. King getting shot. I remember John Kennedy getting shot. So we've had a lot of this in our background, but for our young people, it's so important for us to show guidance and great leadership during this time, because you've got the pandemic. And then on top of that, we've got a real crisis economically. and social economically with people getting sick on top of that. And then you add the racial injustice we've seen lately. So it's a time where leaders need to step up and help change, but also help young people learn about these things and move forward, and hopefully it'll never happen in our country again.
It's so well said. Mack Brown is my guest. And so, Mack, having said all of that, I'm curious, how have you gone about dealing with the pandemic with your players, your staff, and your program, and everything else that's going on around the nation right now?
Jim, we're so lucky. We're very transparent with our team. There are no elephants in the room. So we talk about race all the time. We've talked about racial injustice, and the premise of our program is to be fair, be consistent, and do what you know is the right thing to do. And really, that's what America needs to do. That's what our world has to do. So what we've done is we have a black police chief named David Perry, who played football at Albany State. He was a quarterback, and he is a superstar. So we've had him on with our parents. We've had him on with our players at least twice, maybe three times, to talk about police forces across the country, to talk about the injustice that's happening and protest, and talking about protests in Chapel Hill or Durham or Raleigh and how our players could be involved in a peaceful way, how he feels like that our players should be involved. And really, I've asked him to address how the white guys on the team should feel. What should they say? How can they help? And what can they do? And that's been very productive. We're actually looking at right now ways to get our players to vote, to make sure they do in the future. And we're looking at ways that to be classy, but to make sure that we honor the change that we would like individually and as a team. And like I told the guys, I don't send out tweets until Jeremy Sharp, our director of communication, reads them. So I would expect them to do the same thing. You can express yourself, but do it in a professional way. Do it in a classy way, and don't do it under anger at somebody else and put yourself in a position where it may cost you an opportunity in the NFL or it may cost you a job when you get out. On the pandemic side, we're really lucky, Jim, that we've got one of the stronger medical centers in the country. I think maybe Boston, San Francisco, and the Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill area, we've got such great doctors and research here. So they've guided us. We actually have players coming in for the first time tomorrow. And we had a meeting with the doctors and our parents. We had a meeting, two meetings with our doctors and our players, just to make sure that they understood everything that we were doing to ensure their safety on a return. And we've had our mental health people talk to them because there's been a lot of mental health issues that have popped up over the last 3 months for people that normally don't feel that stress or anxiety or depression. And so we've encouraged our guys who are at a real susceptible time for suicide, and for depression and poor decisions, we've really tried to make sure that they have people talking to them constantly, but they have help available so they can do that. So, and we wanted to make sure we weren't on the call with the doctors and our staff that's helping the reentry, because we wanted to make sure the parents and the players could ask any questions without coaches being there, feeling like it was pressure. And we've also tried to make sure that all of our staff, our coaches, and our players feel comfortable coming back, Jim. We will come back as a staff on Monday, but we've got some older staff members that I'm holding out for them to stay at home and still Zoom with all their meetings just till we make sure that all of our players are tested, all of our staff's tested, and that we don't have the virus around so somebody that's 75 or 70 would feel uncomfortable.
North Carolina head football coach Mack Brown is joining us. You know, Mack, you and I spoke last August, and I have to say, at that time, I was genuinely fired up to have you back on the program and to hear the passion you had for that program and the excitement you had for the season. Then you go out and you win 7 games. You blow Temple out in the bowl game. When you look back on last season, Mack, what kind of thoughts and memories do you have?
Jim, number one, it reinforces that I made the right decision to come back. because I loved my TV gig, but I had a void, and the void was these kids. And that's what's been so hard for me. I've been up and down emotionally for the last 3 months because I came back to be around the kids. My wife, Sally, came back to be around the kids, and they weren't here. We've missed them. So that's a huge part of what we're doing now is mentoring kids, and we've been able to do it through Zoom, but it's just different. And it's not the same when you can't see their faces all the time and their reactions, and when you've got 120 kids on, they can't ask you the same questions they would if they can walk in your office. So I'm really looking forward to them getting back. But the other thing that happened, Jim, that's so exciting for us is that we open up and we beat South Carolina, and then we come back and we beat Miami. I'm not sure we were able to handle those two wins, so we didn't play well the next 2 weeks against Wake Forest and Appalachian, and then came back and had a chance to beat Clemson, but we lost five defensive starters after that, and we played okay, but I thought we were in a position where we could win 10 games and instead of the seven that we had, but we ended up getting some guys back, playing a lot more depth, and I really like the way our team played the last three games. We were a really good team, and I think we could have played with about anybody.
We're talking to Mac Brown. Mac, let me ask you about your young quarterback, Sam Howell. He had an amazing season as a true freshman. You've said that he's got some Colt McCoy in him because of his accuracy. That, of course, is incredibly high praise. How do you explain what he did last year as a true freshman, and how good can he be?
I think he can be as good as anybody, Jim. He's got a real calmness about him. It's a calmness and a confidence. So he is a great leader without saying a whole lot. He competes so well every day. He played with a sore ankle. He played with a sore shoulder and a sore knee and didn't even miss a practice, never complained about anything. And he's the hardest worker on the team. He's over a 3.0 in his first year in college. He's on the all-academic team. So he's got it all. And you said it. He's very accurate. I've never seen a more accurate thrower than Colt McCoy. At one point, he was in the high 70s with his completion percentage, and the balls never hit the ground in practice. And I'm seeing those same things out of Sam. Now, we lost our backups last year at quarterback. We didn't have any experience, so we didn't let him run. I think the fact that he can run now, which he did in the bowl game, is really going to help his production for next year.
We're talking to Mac Brown for a few more moments. You know, Mac, maybe I'm reaching here. Tell me if I am. But a few weeks back, everybody was watching The Last Dance. Of course, you're coaching at Michael Jordan's alma mater, and you are a Jordan Brand school. I mean, of course, he played basketball, and you're coaching football. But when you're recruiting, how much of a draw is Michael Jordan and that brand?
Jim, he's a huge draw. You know, Michael Jordan is Michael Jordan, and he's one of those we talk about is he the best ever? Well, if he's not, I think he is, then he's in that group of two or three. And the fact that he's got his brand of shoes, and these kids love shoes. Now I know what the Concords are, and I got my Jordans down. I'm wearing them every day. And
there you go.
It's important to these kids. And the fact that we had The Last Dance, I charged every one of our players and coaches to watch it. And the thing you come away with is there's never been anybody more competitive than Michael Jordan. And he's really helped us. We have a Jordan experience room with all the Jordans that have all the shoes since the start that are mounted so the kids can see them. We've got a great quote from Michael in that room that's really cool and important for all of our kids to see. I was with him at the Gonzaga game last year, and I said, You let Florida wear your shoes. You let Oklahoma wear your shoes. You let Michigan wear your shoes. Why didn't you just let us wear them?
Right.
And nobody else. Michael's so competitive. He said, why don't you win some games? And then you start telling me what I need to be doing with my shoes. So I said, I got you, Michael. I'm in.
Wow. You got it, Mike. That's a great story. You know, Mac, finally, from the outside, it seems like there's so much buzz and momentum surrounding the program coming off of last season. I'm curious what it feels like to you on the inside. Is it something that you're feeling? And if so, how would you describe it?
Jim, it is. It's probably more of a buzz and better at this stage than I thought it could be. Number one, we sold out every game last year, and we were only one of seven teams to do that. And our season tickets, with this craziness about where are we going to have football, are we going to have a full season, who gets to come, we're already at 94% renewal for season tickets for next year, which is just absolutely crazy. Our recruiting, we're in the top five in most of the recruiting services, and we'll just keep getting better. There's some more great players out there that are wanting to come. And I think we've got a really good team coming back. We needed to develop depth in the spring, so our coaches are going to have to do a tremendous job of doing that in preseason, because it hurt us, because we're just not a very deep team yet. And I think we'll be good this year. I think people better grab and hold on in 2 years, because I think we're about to be really good.
He is the head football coach at the University of North Carolina. Once again, a two-time National Coach of the Year. He won that national championship at Texas. Mack Brown, my guest. Mack, so good to get caught up. Again, I'm amazed at how quickly this thing is turning. I know you have work ahead of you, but I thought you had an amazing year. It's good to have you back on the show. I'll look forward to seeing the team once again when you get back out there, Mack.
Thanks, Jim. You've been a great friend for many years. And, Jim, let me thank again first responders who, through all of this stuff, have kept us afloat. And our healthcare people, they're just superstars and heroes, and I get emotional when I start talking about them. But I'm getting ready to go back to work. These people have had no choice, and they've been working since the beginning. We're all running from the virus. They've been fighting to keep it away from us. So God bless them, and may they stay safe.
Now, let's not make any bones about this. This next dude is the dude to beat, and not just because he has the most recent strap or the most recent two straps, actually. No, that's not the reason. This guy's the man to beat because he is the best of a generation that is still going strong. You don't believe me? Check out his five titles in just 11 smack-offs. I don't know what else you can call a dude who has won damn near half of the events that he has shown up for. Look, no disrespect to the rest of the field, but everybody knows who the favorite is going into June 19th. It's not exactly breaking news for me to sit here and say that. That man is the BIC, Brad, in Corona. Right now, Brad is the double champ, the champ champ. He went back-to-back last year for the first time in his highly decorated smack-off career. That moved him into a tie with Sean the Cabernasian for most titles ever at five. And with Shawnee himself back in the mix, we are now on a GOAT collision course. I can't wait for this. A week from tomorrow. Yesterday, it was about Sean. Today, it's about Brad. Now, the Brad haters will tell you the same thing today that they've been saying for the past decade plus. That this dude does not have sports takes. If you think that's the first time that the BIC has heard that, you'd be wrong. In fact, he addressed that way back in 2010 when he said this.
I don't have any sports takes because I don't have my own sports talk radio show. This is the Jim Rome Show, you idiot. No one cares about my sports takes. No one cares about your sports takes. I've never woken up in the morning and gone, gee, I wonder what Mike in Indy has to say about the collective bargaining agreement. You know why? It's because I know the only collective bargaining agreement Mike in Indy's ever been a part of involved four of his buddies, a crack pipe, and a toothless prostitute at the Circus Circus Casino Hotel in Las Vegas.
My dude's got a point, right? Never have I said, have a sports take, don't suck. I've always just said, have a take, don't suck. And Brad's got takes for days. And they don't suck. You don't believe me? Ask Jay Moore. Ask the Cabernation. They both simultaneously got wrapped up in the same take back in 2011.
Hey, quick shout out to Jay Moore. Jay, a lot of people are clowning you today. I'm here to help. I wrote a screenplay for you. It's based on actual events, and you're going to play the main character in this one. I know, we're way outside your comfort zone already, but I'm not going to pay you anything either. So right back into your wheelhouse there, Jay. Jay, you're going to play the role of Sean the Cabernasian Pendergast, a washed-up 40-something stretch-marked albino walrus and wannabe sports radio broadcaster. Again, not that big of a stretch for you. The title of the movie is 1 Minute and 27 Seconds. I don't want to give away spoilers, but the plot line basically involves your arm getting pinned beneath a rock during a horrible climbing accident. You call for help, quickly run out of breath because you're fat. Then you eat your own arm off 1 minute and 27 seconds later when you get hungry. Long story short, instead of going to get help, you bleed to death while trying to barbecue your tricep.
This guy. So as an equal opportunity takedown artist, he has gone after everybody from the very top of the jungle food chain all the way down to the very bottom. And then back in 2019, we had one of our biggest mismatches ever. It unfolded as Matt in LA and Brad traded on the air in the type of fight that does not need any spoiler alerts. I think you already know how that one went.
Matt in LA, stop making jokes about Belly Clarkson, dude. You're fatter than Belly Clarkson. It doesn't make sense. You can't make fun of someone for being fat when you're fatter and uglier than they are. That's not how this works, dude. Matthew is a troubled young man, Jim. I don't know if you've ever checked out his Twitter feed, but his posts are borderline insane. He's like an even dumber version of Ray Lewis, if that makes any sense. He wakes up every morning and posts, "Thank you, God. God is amazing." Which is fine, but then he chases that with four pictures that are so random they look like one of those tests you have to take on a website to prove you're not a robot. We don't need to see pictures of a peacock next to a beware of dog sign. Stop taking drugs, dude.
So I mentioned that Brad is coming off his second straight smack-off win. If you missed any of his call last year, here is a piece of what put him over the top.
I'm not sure, Jimmy, if the Cablin Asian is stupid or if he's just desperate, but Shawnee, you're on the radio once a week, Sunday nights from 6 to 10. Great time slot, bud. What are you, auditioning to be the next Rich Ackerman? I heard CBS was actually considering just broadcasting dead air, but they figured if they could get you for the same price, then what the hell, you know? Speaking of other guys who look like they're about to have a heart attack, Rick in Buffalo did a great job screaming through his call today. He's a funny guy, Jim, calling his mother-in-law a skank, talking about his two-year-old's private parts. That's hysterical. I mean, I know this is radio. I just wish the guy weren't so gosh damned ugly, Jim. Rick in Buffalo is so ugly when he and his wife have sex, she has to close her eyes and pretend he's Tony Kornheiser.
I mean, this guy, he obviously is just doing it at another level. Now, that's not to say that he can't be beaten, because he has been six times. He actually took himself out of one of the events. But the field this year is as deep as it's ever been. It's as strong as it's ever been. And yes, I've been on record already as saying that I can make an argument for six or seven guys getting in Brad's way, or at least getting Brad's attention. But those six or seven are going to have to bring an absolutely perfect game to the main event, because that's what it's going to take to knock this guy out.
Romy, I came to the jungle to drink some beers and talk some smack. Tyler in Shredmonton, I'm the last dude you want to accuse of having an anteater, bro. Canadians are pretty much honorary Euros, which basically guarantees you and your boy Matthew are rocking turtlenecks even when it's hot outside, okay? So go take those adult baby wipes you guys carry around with you 24-7 and clean out some of that schmeg before you come back on my airwaves. Every time they cut to the rest of your crew, it looks like they're the launch team for a missile that just crashed into the ocean.
There's only two types of people in this quarantine. You're either the guy forwarding those memes of that guy with the massive wiener, or you're the guy receiving those memes of that guy with the massive wiener.
Mark in Hollywood, what do your parents tell their friends that you're doing out here exactly?
I'm competing against a bunch of guys who go home to their dogs.
How dare Rich Ackerman come on here last year and try to clown me? Rich, you read 30 seconds of radio highlights twice an hour. You work 1 minute every hour on the radio, Rich. How much does that pay? Even if it pays $500 an hour, you're still only bringing home like $50 a week. Jim, seriously, how is Ackerman still employed? He's like that fat, ugly, redheaded guy Milton from the movie Office Space. Hopefully someone at CBS is listening right now and goes ahead and fixes the glitch. Tyler, you might not be getting enough oxygen to your brain after getting your head jammed halfway up my crack last year. Mark, you're a funny-looking, scarred-up little midget who loves slamming hookers. The Mann brothers have produced more ridiculous crap than a bottle of Jägermeister and a box full of suppositories. If the Mann brothers were horse owners, their stables would consist of one Zenyatta, that's you, Jim, and about 50 of those zebra-painted donkeys that tourists take pictures with when they go down to Mexico. I afraid he won this thing last year and he took the computer as his prize? Giving a 92-year-old guy a computer is borderline elder abuse, Rome.
Chael Sonnen is a purple belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. A purple belt. Dude knew knew he was going to fight people for a living, and he couldn't even be bothered to get a brown belt. Chael, all you have to do to get from purple to brown is just have your mom keep driving you to the lessons. Don't be such a quitter, dude.
I just want to say thanks again for paying me $5,000 to make fun of these guys. Mark's going to make his phone call this year from the Hollywood Costco. Yeah, that's where he panhandles in the parking lot Friday through Sunday. Then he enters that raffle for the free motorcycle, sneaks into the store, and feeds himself on all the free samples. Jeff, did you know that Passan is an anagram of Aspan, which is a synonym for bedpan, which is ironic because your calls are all really smelly and you need to be disposed of. I'm not saying times are hard for Mark in Hollywood, Jim. What I am saying is the only acting work he's had lately consists of trying to convince the cashier at Walmart that the dog food he buys once a week is actually for a dog and not for him to chow down on in the parking lot like they've caught him doing on the regular. Seriously, Rome, I don't know if you've seen Lef's ears lately, but I'm pretty sure with those radar dishes tacked to the sides of his head that that dude can listen to your show without ever actually turning on his radio. Rumor has it he can hear a whisper from over 50 miles away. Hey, Lef, you're a gimmicky little bitch.
Now, Romy, if you'll excuse me, I gotta go home and put some water in Vic in NoCal's mama's dish.
I hope these guys in the Smack Off understand this. You guys are entering a world of pain this year, okay? You're going up against a guy who never talks about sports and is named after the actual pandemic that killed sports this year.
Man's game, bitch.
I'll tell you what, I just canceled the event. Just give it to the guy right now. That is absolutely amazing. And Adam, what's amazing to me about that is Brad, if he's been in 11 of these things, go ahead, throw him on, Adam. If he's been in 11 of these things and he's won five of them, if he's been in 11, I'm going to suggest that over the past decade, Brad's only called this show 15 times total and that we have all of that sound. What was that like for you going through all that sound?
Oh, I had to start last night, honestly. It was a two-day adventure because there's so much material to choose from. Honestly, all of these guys that we've profiled are really, 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 really
like,
good.
Yeah, what's the process? Let me just jump in. What has the process been like for you? Because you are the man behind those super montages. You've heard the very best. You've worked on other shows. You've been in the industry. What was that experience like going through all of that stuff for all of the player profiles and hearing the best of the best?
It's great, especially the stuff that goes back to the mid-90s. It's really fun to see like what Smack was back then versus what it is now. And then so many of these guys, including Brad, which you just heard, have delivered so many great phone calls that just kind of get forgotten about because they happen one summer 5 years ago, and then you get to hear it again. And some of this stuff is just timeless, and I think what we heard right there is just as funny today as it was when it first happened, and a lot of it happened before I got to the show in 2016, so it's been really cool just to go back and listen to all this stuff, and I'm pumped up for next Friday. It's going to be great.
Good job. Well done, Adam Hawk EP. I'm talking about Bruce Feldman. Bruce, it is so good to have you on. In fact, Bruce, it's been a minute or two since we've caught up, so how are you and everybody around you right now?
I'm doing well, thanks, Jim. You know, just trying to be optimistic as everything that's going on around us. So, you know, we've got, you know, it's been obviously for a lot, I mean, for everybody, it's been just a crazy last 3 months, but I appreciate you asking.
You got it, Bruce. Good to have you back. Now, listen, you wrote a piece last month where you spoke with Reggie Bush about the NCAA punishment and his emotions surrounding that. Before we get into the conversation itself, what was your reaction when USC announced that the 10 years of disassociation was over?
You know, I wasn't surprised because it had been trending that direction for a little while, and I think there had been some things that had gone on behind the scenes with really the new leadership at USC, and that's Carol Folt, the president, Mike Bone, the new AD, and his team around him. So I know there have been some Zoom calls. I know that Matt Leiner, who was obviously Reggie's quarterback when they were winning so many games, had really helped kind of bridge this. And I think it's something that I think, you know, certainly Reggie had wanted back when that story you're referencing, you know, for The Athletic, we had talked about, I probably talked with Reggie, I don't know, a half dozen times over the course of a week to, you know, getting into that story. It wasn't just about NIL. That's where it started out to be. But then it went into the NCAA and as well as his feelings on a lot of subjects, especially what went on at USC. So I think, you know, there was some movement from that point on from about a month ago. And I just think that a lot of people around USC and inside USC looked and go, hey, it's way past time. We need to do this. And I think given the climate of everything going on around college athletics, I think it just made a lot of sense.
Bruce Feldman's my guest. So, Bruce, when you spoke to him, how would you describe his thoughts and his emotions? For instance, how much of a toll has this taken on him?
A lot more than I think probably most people realize. Obviously he was like a phenomenon when he was in college football and they were winning and you know, obviously a huge media market here in Southern California. And then he goes to the Saints, and I think there were times where he was injured. There were times where I think he was struggling. I think a lot of that weighed on him, you know, from talking to him for that story. It was a rough roller coaster ride for him, because one of the things that Reggie had told me was when you're, you know, because I'd asked him about kind of when you blow up as a player and all of a sudden now you go to stadiums and you see people are wearing your jersey when do you realize you're kind of a commodity? And he said that the hardest thing is when you realize that people close to you sometimes are the ones who you have to watch out for the most. And that's a tough lesson to learn, he said, because, you know, compliance people or coaches can tell you, hey, you know, you got to watch out for boosters, or you got to watch out for agents or whatnot. But when it's the people who you think you can trust and that goes, you know, in the wrong direction, it really can be unsettling. And I think that was really, really hard on him. I mean, some of the depth and details of the things we talked about, I would, you know, leave up to him to, if he wants to reveal at a later point. But I think it was definitely, it was eye-opening for me to hear some of that from him and some of the details of it, just because it's not something that I think most people had assumed, because you're like, hey, you're looking at this guy, he's married with three kids and he's on TV and he had a, you know, 10-year career and he, you know, he won a Super Bowl, and I know that was great for him, for, you know, to help the rebuilding and the healing around Katrina for that community around New Orleans. But there was a lot of other stuff that went to it. And, you know, I think some of this is tied into, you know, when you have a value system a little bit that is the way it's set up. And he talked about when he first, you know, he's telling me how he really came to love football, and part of the reason that he explained it was he wanted his biological father to see him and wanted him to come around more. And just like that was some of the things that he saw as a little kid, to use football to do that. And so when you start hearing that, you could say, okay, you know, I could see how your trust issues and even some of your value system can get skewed when that's how you see it, and then all of a sudden you're kind of watching how you come up through the system and how you can feel like a commodity and how you can kind of look at the world through that lens.
To your point, Bruce, I don't think too many people on the outside look at him and think like that. You'd have no idea. But, of course, we have no idea what these guys are going through. We really don't know these guys that well. But then when you have a conversation like that, you get a better understanding. And then you look at an era right now, Bruce, where everything is very different. Like, you could look at what happened, the choices that he made back then, and they look and feel much different now because everything has changed. For instance, if there had been an open market for his name, his image, and his likeness at that time, when you consider the success that USC was having and the fact that he was playing in Los Angeles, the fact that he had this style of play that was just electric, what kind of money could he have been looking at in terms of compensation back then?
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things that was really fascinating to work on. In that story, I talked to the CEO of Navigate, which is a sports business strategy firm, and they're the experts kind of in this field. And I said, okay, can you project what Reggie Bush would have made? And as you said, huge media market, style of play, they were on top of the world, you know, in sports. They were just a bigger deal than what you're seeing even now, as great of quarterbacks as like a Joe Burrow was last year, or Trevor Lawrence, or it's a different level of reach and range that he could have commanded. They estimated, and this is by their viewpoint, that he could have made $2 to $3 million at the time of his USC career. Now, what's crazy about that is pre-social media. Reggie Bush has like 3 million Twitter followers now. We're not even talking about Twitter followers or any of that stuff, which you can project now to what athletes may have and what they could try to leverage. This is even before really social media. They said Reggie Bush could have made $2 to $3 million, and that would have been what he could have commanded from apparel deals, beverage deals, supplement companies, maybe local businesses, say like furniture stores or things of that nature. And that doesn't even get into then the appearance component, which is the thing right now the NCAA is trying to figure that out. Like, let's say that some, you know, donor decides, hey, I want to spend $50,000 to have Reggie Bush come to my kid's birthday party just because I want, you know, all my neighbors to be jealous. I mean, if Reggie Bush does 10 of those appearances, that's $500,000. That's, you know, money that, as you know, brought that up back to Reggie as for the story. And he said, he goes, that is mind blowing. That's like life changing money. The money that we're talking about, you know, in the other context where it's $3,000 or $5,000 here or there, he goes, yeah, that helps pay the bills and that takes some pressure off. But when you're talking about $500,000 and you see everything else, everybody else is making money off of you, he said, that in retrospect, you know, is such a game changer to think of it through that prism.
We're talking to Bruce Feldman. I absolutely agree with that. Now, Clemson and Utah, Bruce, have been dealing with allegations of staff members using racial slurs in the past. Iowa appears to have a much larger issue, with player after player expressing concerns about the strength coach, Chris Doyle, assistant coach Brian Ferentz as well, and the overall culture of that program. What do you make of the situation, Bruce, with the Hawkeyes?
I think that's the one that is honestly the most volatile, because you've had so many players come out and speak out on social media. It started James Daniels, who was a really good player for Iowa a few years ago, is now in the NFL, had broached the subject, and a lot of players have spoken up with their own anecdotes and stories, and just so many. I mean, it's not like it's been five or six. It's been over 40 who have come forward. Most of the allegations stem in mistreatment along racial lines. There's some other ones that are also just straight up bullying stories of that. And I think what they're doing now is, there's been Iowa has tried or is trying to really sort all this out, with having some former players as point people on getting to the bottom of what really happened. I think the biggest thing you're hearing from them is, hey, we know some things were not handled appropriately. We know that this culture did not treat everyone fairly or appropriately. And how can we get better from this? And that's one of the things. Now, you know, Chris Doyle has come out on, put on social media that he denies these allegations. And so we'll see what gets determined or found in the conclusions that they come of this. But again, there's been more allegations that have surfaced even since the suspension. And it's going to be interesting to see what direction things go there. I mean, Kirk Ferentz has been there a long time, as you mentioned. His son Brian he's not on leave. His son Brian's the offensive coordinator there. There was a few allegations, you know, tied to him. Most of them are tied to the strength coach, but there's a few other assistants who are referenced in some of these things. And there's a lot to clean out, and there's a lot to clean up, and especially when you have so many players who really feel like they've been treated unfairly. And a lot of those players who've spoken out, not all, but a lot of them, were guys who actually had a lot of success there. And there's also some of their white teammates have also, you know, feel like they've really got a lot more listening to do, and feel, you know, seem to have a lot of remorse about how things have been handled for so long there. And I think Kirk Ferentz is in that same boat, talking about, you know, clearly they didn't do enough to listen to some of these concerns in the past.
Bruce Feldman joining me for another moment or so. Bruce, last topic really quickly. You've got a piece up about UCLA, where Chip Kelly is entering his third season. He's got 17 losses in his first 2 years. That's 10 more than he had in his first 4 years at Oregon. Is it a case where maybe college football caught up to him, or is this more of a rebuilding job than people first thought?
I think it's more the latter. I mean, look, if you look at Mike Leach when he took over Washington State, they struggled his first 3 seasons there, and people are like, okay, everyone caught up to what he's doing because it's more permeated. Now, what's different about Leach than Chip Kelly is, Chip Kelly has really changed a lot of what he's doing schematically compared to Leach. Is still the air raid guy. But I think a lot of what has affected Chip Kelly was They have not had good depth. I think he's really kind of had to flip the roster. You talk to people inside the program, they are very optimistic. They think they have a budding star in Dorian Thompson-Robinson, who's a junior quarterback who has, they feel like he's ready to have a breakout year, and they're going to need it because they're going to need him. They're going to need the offensive line, which they feel like they finally have some depth in the receiving core. I'm not sure how good they're going to be on defense, but one thing that also bodes well for them is their non-conference schedule, which has been brutal his first 2 years, is much more manageable, and maybe they can get some momentum going and build off and maybe get to 8 wins, which I think people would see as a lot of growth and a big step in the right direction there.
And then finally, Bruce, I had a conversation with Mac Brown earlier in the program. We talked about the fact that his first group of players are returning tomorrow. What do you make of how schools and programs are dealing with COVID-19 and the return of players to campus?
I think by and large, the ones that are almost everyone is testing. There's a few schools that I'm not sure if their protocols are the same. And I think the question is going to be, you know, it seems like there's a low risk when you're talking about college age players, especially the ones, you know, those, you know, in the conditioning, you know, the question I think that people are trying to sort out is what happens to the staff and some of the people who are maybe 55 and up, maybe they have their health, their conditioning isn't ideal. It's what's going to be the case for some of those folks, because I think one of the things having talked to a lot of coaches around the country now is there are pretty much 2 or 3 or 4 guys on every staff that fit into that risk category. I mean, do those guys they're not going to quarantine, or I don't think, at least maybe there'll be a few cases of that, but look, I mean, Mac Brown is close to 70. Frank Solich is mid 70s. There's plenty of coaches who are over 60 and probably not in as good shape as physically as some of those guys. I think those are the ones that people are going to be most concerned about in this. And, you know, then the big question is going to be, will we have full stands or not? This is, to me, you know, people are going to see what happens a month from now, where we are with the virus. Hopefully there will not be the risk that I think a lot of people fear there will be. But right now, I think the best they can do is listen to the experts around them and try to, you know, try to practice as much smart precautionary stuff as they can with their protocols and procedures in place, because I think there's going to be a lot of contingencies that right now they hope they don't have to get into in potential worst case scenarios. But I think those are, you know, on some of the people's minds as they're kind of just now getting into this.
He is a reporter for Fox Sports and FS1, a writer for The Athletic, a New York Times bestselling author, and his most recent book is The QB. Bruce Feldman, my guest. Great job, Bruce. Always good to have you on the show and good to get caught up, Bruce.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Take care.
Thanks. You too, Bruce. Brad, what's going on?
I want to hear from an uncircumcised Euro in Rancho Penasquitos. If you live in Solana Beach, Carlsbad, Encinitas, and you were called a turtleneck in high school, give me a call. Jimmy, thank you for the Vine. I'm honored by the profile. Really grateful to you and the crew for keeping this thing that we all love going. I feel like we need this right now. I'm stoked for next Friday. You know, a lot of guys announce their retirements when they've been around as long as I have. I'm here today to announce the opposite. I am never retiring, ever. Sorry, guys in the field. Screw all of you equally and super hard. Jim, I don't know what I'm even going to say next week when I call. I'm still waiting to get my script from Rich Flores and meet with his production crew. Hopefully it's as hot or hotter than when Rich took that mega bottle of spicy sriracha sauce to the Huntington Beach City Council a couple weeks ago. Yeah, Rich, I was just reading through my script and the agenda and just Googling earlier, and what's with Lithuania? It's just bizarre. There's a lot of uncircumcised Euros there. Just bizarre, really. Anyway, Jimbo, no one's beating me next Friday. You know that. I know that. The field knows it too, Jimmy. This is my year. It's my virus. Like Stevie Wonder getting an eye exam, I am 2020, baby. See you boys next Friday.
My man, Bradley. In Corona. That's the man to beat. Let's go to Houston. My man, Jerome. Jerome, how you feeling today?
I'm doing fine, Vance Mack. Thanks for the vine. Thanks for the time. Good to listen. Love your show as always. Hey, I was just thinking about how awesome this little spring and summer's been for me. Even though I've listened to the show for over 25 years, just the last 3 months, I've lived the whole clone lifetime. Got in, made some calls, got the golden ticket, and then I got Smacky Helicopter. And I'm trying to fight back. I want that thing. I want that bad boy back. Spring and summer, it's just eye-opening. You learn a lot about things that you wouldn't even think about, and that's really, really opened my eyes to a lot of things. Y'all are a great group. I hope y'all stay together for always. So anyway, one thing, this is, you all well know, this corona thing kind of hit me hard, meaning I hit myself hard with a lot of baking and drinking and all that. I just want to say, we got called back to the office this week, Monday, and did not prep. And I tell you what, give yourself a little time, clones. If you got to go back, you got some morning, take a week or so, kind of ease off, because I went back that Monday. And I'm going to tell you what, Rome, about 10:30 in the morning, I was shaking like a dog pooping a peach seed, and it wasn't fun. So take some time, ease off before you get back. Otherwise, you'll have a bad, bad day. I'm out. Love the jungle. Hope to get in. Out.
My man, Jerome. What the hell? Give it back. Give him a golden ticket. You just earned it back, Jerome. You know why? Because you had really good advice.
Good night now!